From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
2013, a tipping point for same-sex marriage. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. 10 days ago, a district court in Utah upheld the constitutional right of same-sex couples to marry. If the ruling stands, Utah will be the 18th state in the nation to permit such unions, twice as many as there were last summer when the Supreme Court stopped short of taking a definitive stand on the issue. Activists are hailing the development as a turning point for gay rights. Opponents are decrying judicial activism. By this time next year, will same-sex marriage be the norm in America? Also on today's Talking Point, does familiarity breed success? Why movie sequels ruled at the box office this year. First, the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
We're back with To The Point. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Warren Olney. Just ahead, Utah could become the 18th state to permit same-sex marriage, and lawsuits over gay marriage are working their way through the courts in 17 other states. Is 2013 the tipping point for same-sex marriage in America? That's coming up. Later on today's Talking Point, Hollywood keeps mining the same material. Why movie franchises dominated the box office in 2013. First, this news update. Two deadly bombings have struck the southern Russian city of Volgograd in the past 2 days. At least 30 people are dead, and there are as many as 70 wounded in what appear to be suicide attacks. Although Volgograd is hundreds of miles away from the site of the February Olympics in Sochi, the violence has raised concerns about terrorism at the Games. Sunday's explosion took place at Volgograd's main train station. Today's blast destroyed a trolley during the morning rush hour. Will England joins us. He is the Moscow correspondent for The Washington Post. Good to have you here.
Great to be with you.
Now, has anyone stepped forward and claimed responsibility for these bombings?
Actually, no, not at this point. The authorities believe that the man who conducted the bombing at the train station on Sunday, that they think they know who he was, and they think he's a convert to Islam and had some connections to radical groups in the Caucasus region of Dagestan, where much of the separatist and religious trouble takes place in Russia.
And do the bombings follow a pattern of terrorist violence right in that region?
Well, there is a constant kind of background level of violence particularly in the eastern parts of the Caucasus Mountains. There was the war fought by the Chechens for independence from Russia, which they lost in the 90s. And the separatists were, in a sense, radicalized by that experience and have come out of that as with a much more kind of religious bent than they had before. So there's been this long-running struggle between the forces of the law and order in Russia and the radical extremist, separatist-leaning groups in the Caucasus. Russia loses more interior ministry troops in this fight over the course of a year, let's say, than the United States loses in Afghanistan. I mean, it is that debilitating a fight.
And is there any evidence that these attacks are linked in some way to the Olympics in Sochi in February? There have been warnings that Islamist separatists will attempt something.
Yes, one of the primary leaders of the separatist movement vowed in July that he had kind of called a truce for a while on terrorist attacks in Russia itself. And he said, we're going to stop that now. We need to essentially disrupt the Olympics. There's a dispute about whether the Olympics are taking place on ground that is sacred to some of the original inhabitants of that area. And it would appear that these bombings in Volgograd were inspired by that or planned by him or have in some way linked. No one has come out and said, this is because of the Olympics.
How is the Russian government reacting to the bombings?
Well, interestingly, they are conducting a huge security sweep in Volgograd itself, which is understandable. And President Putin today, you know, ordered the security services to report to him on how they can tighten security around the country. What's interesting is that almost everyone agrees the security in Sochi itself and in the Olympic venues around Sochi is just about watertight. It's very, very, very strict. It's an almost impossible target for a terrorist group. And in a way, that hardening of Sochi, if I could put it that way, may be influencing groups and directing them to conduct their violence elsewhere. This may be why Volgograd was chosen as a target. You say it's 400 miles away, but of course this is a very, very big country, so that doesn't seem that far here.
Well, and that speaks to this criticism that President Putin has been criticized for a heavy-handed approach in dealing with separatist rebels in the region. So you think this is a fair assessment?
That
it might be inciting terrorism.
Provoking terrorism? Yes, possibly, yes. I think there's a lot of concern about that. I think also what's interesting is that the main concern here, beyond the horrible toll in, human life and damage, is the effect this may have on the foreign audience, perhaps even more than the Russian audience, because there has been a history of terrorist attacks here, and people have become somewhat accustomed to them, just the way the British did during the troubles in Northern Ireland in the late 20th century. If this really alarms the kind of people who might otherwise think that the Olympics are a great thing and a showcase for showing how modern and advanced and progressive Russia is, then that becomes a problem.
Will England is Moscow correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks so much for this.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Just ahead, same-sex marriage. Is the recent ruling in Utah a tipping point for the issue? We'll talk about strategies on both sides of the gay marriage debate. And that's next on To the Point. Stay with us.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're back with To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. 10 days ago, a U.S. district judge in Utah struck down the state's ban on same-sex marriage, essentially calling it a fundamental right. If the ruling stands, Utah will be the 18th state to permit such marriages, twice the number that existed before the Supreme Court rulings of last summer, which stopped short of deciding the constitutionality of gay marriage. Some activists see this immediate victory in the Mormon stronghold state of Utah as a turning point for gay rights. Meanwhile, the state of Utah is planning its appeal to the Supreme Court. Brooke Adams is the social justice reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, where does the state stand with the appeal right now?
Well, they said that they would file an appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court either Friday or Monday. They had initially planned to file it last Thursday, but then they delayed as they seek outside help to craft the appeal. And we're still waiting. They didn't do it on Friday, and nothing has yet happened today.
Now, how are people in Utah reacting to the news of this ruling?
It's hard to tell, but it's mixed. We've had in the newspaper letters for and against the ruling. We've had opinion pieces that are on both sides of the issue. We have so it's mixed, I would say, at this point.
And couples, I understand, are just flocking to get married. What's the scene at the courthouses?
Well, it's been packed at the county clerk's offices throughout the state. In the first 3.5 days after the ruling, there were about 900 same-sex marriages took place here, which was about 74% of all the marriage licenses issued in that time period.
Wow, what a rush.
Yeah.
How is the Mormon Church responding?
You know, they've been kind of quiet as this case began its process in the federal court. They hadn't opined about it. But the day the ruling came out, they did issue a statement saying that they supported the ban that had been in place and would now watch to see how this played out through the judicial system.
Huh. Now, do you have a fix on how much support there is for same-sex marriage in the state?
Yeah, so the ban that amended Utah's constitution that banned same-sex marriage was passed by voters about a decade ago, and it was approved by 66% of the voters. There have not been any real good substantive polls since then, but a couple of voter demographic think tanks, one at BYU, took a look at public support and where it stood, and it looked like it had just edged up a little bit. And that survey was done in 2012, so that's still pre the Supreme Court rulings on the issue and pre-developments in Utah, such as a group called Mormons Building Bridges that came out a year or so ago and participated in the Gay Pride Parade here in the state, which was sort of a groundbreaking event. So, you know, some polls appear to show a slight increase in support and acceptance, but it's definitely not overwhelming by those measures.
So unclear on consensus, and there's no major protest, no huge public outcry?
No huge public outcry yet that we've seen. I don't know if anything's in the works. There was a huge rally on the proponents of same-sex marriage that took place, I think it was Friday night, and that drew quite a big group of supporters, but that's the only public show other than what we've seen happening at the county courthouses.
Well, Brooke Adams is the social justice reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Doug Najame is an attorney and professor of law at UC Irvine. Welcome to The Point.
Thank you.
So how significant is this case in Utah?
Well, it's significant because it's one of the first times we're seeing a federal court applying the principles that the Supreme Court announced last June when it issued its decision in Windsor, the case striking down part of the Defense of Marriage Act, and applying that to a state marriage prohibition. There's lots of cases around the country that pose this question. There was a rush of litigation after the Supreme Court's decisions, and now we have a district court opinion that other judges will look to for guidance that sets the stage for more opinions to come, likely.
And what's the basis for the judge's written argument in overturning the ban?
So the judge went on two different routes, one due process and the other equal protection. The due process route says that there's a fundamental right to marry that's protected by the federal constitution, and that right to marry applies to same-sex couples just as it applies to different-sex couples. The judge went through all of the Supreme Court's cases involving the right to marry over the past several decades and said that the right is not linked necessarily to procreation or to gender differentiation, but in fact is about commitment of adult couples and raising children regardless of how those children are brought into the family to some extent. And that applies equally to same-sex couples. And then the court also said that the law denies gay and lesbian people equal protection under the law. And the reasoning from Windsor, which struck down DOMA based on equal protection, persuaded the judge that the law in Utah was also unconstitutional.
Well, given the reach of his reasoning and that Utah is appealing the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court, how is the court likely to respond?
Yeah, so what's happening right now is that the Utah is actually trying to get the U.S. Supreme Court to stay the decision, meaning to place a hold on its effect until the appellate courts are able to weigh in. The judge did not issue a stay. Remember in California when we had the litigation involving Proposition 8, the district court judge there also said the law was unconstitutional, but the decision was stayed pending review by the Ninth Circuit and U.S. Supreme Court. And so couples in California didn't start to marry until the U.S. Supreme Court actually gave us its decision in June 2013, 3 years after the district court ruled. Here, the district court didn't stay its ruling, and the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed, meaning it didn't stay the ruling either. And so what Utah is trying to do is get the U.S. Supreme Court to put the brakes on, allowing then the appellate process to work its way out on the substance, before same-sex couples in Utah can marry. Obviously, same-sex couples are already marrying in Utah, they want that those marriage licenses to stop issuing.
And so long-term, what options does this leave the justices? Does this mean they'll have to rule on the constitutionality question at some point?
It was clear from the U.S. Supreme Court's rulings in June that they were hoping to avoid deciding the question of state marriage bans, at least for a couple terms. And what's become clear in the past several months after the court's decision is that they likely don't have as much time as they thought they might have. And they don't need to decide the merits right now in the Utah case, but it does suggest that given how many cases are currently in the federal courts right now, a lot of them moving quite quickly. There's also a case pending right now at the Ninth Circuit involving Nevada's marriage law, that the court might have to decide this question sooner rather than later.
Well, you're referring to these 18 states that permit same-sex marriage now and many more that are considering moving the cases through the courts. What's spurring on the change in the legal status of gay unions so quickly?
Yeah, so we saw public opinion changing rapidly, and we've also seen political leaders move towards support for marriage more firmly in the Democratic Party, increasingly in the Republican Party, and even before the Supreme Court gave us its decisions in June, between the time the court heard argument and the time it issued its decision, three more states had moved into the marriage column. And so I think what you see is responses to the clear public support, the clear political support, and a sense that this is where we're heading, and states wanting to move in that direction sooner rather than later. And the court, in many ways, by resisting deciding the big question about state marriage bans last June, which it could have done in the Perry case, was hoping, I think, at least some of the justices, that more states would do exactly what they're doing, and that by the time the Supreme Court actually decides the question, there won't be a majority of states that it would be striking down state laws for, but in fact, it would be regional outliers. And I think that's what we're moving towards. We're seeing strong support now in laws on the West Coast, in the Northeast, and in the Upper Midwest.
Doug Najame, attorney and professor of law at UC Irvine. Marcia Ternus joins us now. She's former Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court. In 2009, she participated in the unanimous ruling that it was unconstitutional for Iowa to deny marriage licenses based on sexual orientation. She and her fellow judges in that case were subsequently voted out of office in judicial retention elections. And welcome to the show.
Hello. Nice to be here.
So, Marcia Ternus, what reasoning factored into that decision in 2009?
The decision was based solely on the Equal Protection Clause found in the Iowa Constitution. And we basically held that the legislature, the state, could not deny the same status and over 200 benefits and privileges that flowed from the marital status on the basis of sexual orientation.
Now, when you made it, how aware were you and your fellow judges of where public opinion stood in Iowa on same-sex marriage?
Well, you know, it's been almost 5 years, and I can't say that I have a crystal clear recollection of that because, honestly, we didn't really pay any attention to it, and we certainly never talked about it. I think I personally was certainly aware that probably the majority of Iowans did not were not accepting of same-sex marriage because I believe there were several polls that were done that showed that.
Now, after the ruling, how did people in Iowa react?
Well, it's interesting. I heard the speaker from Utah, and I think the response here was more or less the same. There were great displays of opposition and great displays of joy. And certainly the court received emails and letters on both sides of the issue. It really wasn't until the retention elections and all the outside organizations and money getting involved that we saw a real backlash.
And did you have any idea, as you were deliberating, that you might lose your job over that case in 2009?
Well, like I said, that was nothing that we ever discussed, and I don't think any of us really gave it any thought, even though we certainly, I think, were aware of that. And in fact, at the very end of our process in deciding the case and writing the opinion, after we had given the opinion to our secretarial staff and said, okay, we're done nitpicking it, it's ready to go, you can do whatever needs to be done to release it. I came back into the courtroom and the justice, we were all in the, or not the courtroom, in the conference room, and one of the justices looked around the table and said, you know, we could lose our jobs for what we just did. And, of course, three of us did.
Now, tell us about the retention elections the following year, in 2010. And you'd been on the bench for 17 years already, right? So you'd been through retention elections before. How did these compare?
Well, this is my third retention election, and it was unlike any of the prior ones. There had never been organized opposition or really any visible opposition to the retention of a Supreme Court justice, even though under our judicial ethics code, we could form campaign committees for the retention election and raise money to fund those campaigns. No one had ever done that. But this year, in 2010, there was a lot of money that came in from outside the state, over $1 million, and they undertook a very broad and vigorous campaign against the three members of the court who were on the retention ballot that year.
Doug Najem, how does that compare to other instances of strategic investment in fighting the cause of same-sex marriage in America?
Yeah, well, the National Organization for Marriage has poured a lot of money into state fights over marriage, including into the retention elections in Iowa. But I think we're seeing a retraction of some of the funding that's being given to the cause against same-sex marriage. Funders now, or the National Organization for Marriage in particular, is looking at Indiana, which is one of the only states that doesn't have a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage or a law permitting same-sex marriage, and they've been hoping to get a constitutional amendment there. But the targets for the opponents of same-sex marriage, those targets are dwindling, and in fact, it seems that most of the action is actually on the same-sex marriage side through affirmative litigation and state legislative efforts.
Doug Najem is attorney and professor of law at UC Irvine. Marcia Ternus is former Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court. And we also heard from Brooke Adams, social justice reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. And Marcia Ternus, she and two of her fellow judges lost retention elections, as you heard, the year after they voted to uphold same-sex marriage in Iowa. After the break, we'll hear from the head of an organization that helped unseat our guest. Also, later on today's Talking Point, why does Hollywood keep making the same movie over and over again? And why do we keep on watching? We're back in a minute with more To the Point from PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
We're back with more To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney. And if you're just joining us, the topic is same-sex marriage. Will the recent district court ruling upholding same-sex marriage in the conservative state of Utah force the Supreme Court's hand on deciding the constitutionality of gay marriage? And where do the American people stand on the issue? Also, how are opponents of same-sex marriage working to ensure it not become the law of the land? Marcia Ternus, former Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court, joins us. She lost a election after ruling in favor of same-sex marriage in 2009. Also with us is Doug Najem, attorney and associate professor of law at UC Irvine. And I want to continue our conversation with you, Marcia Ternus, just finish up. You were talking about your reflections on this decision in Utah and another state where there's a lower level of support for gay marriage, as was somewhat similar in Iowa. What's the likelihood of a backlash like you suffered in Iowa, do you think?
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, I'm not sure how judges are chosen in Utah, but most states do have some form of judicial election, whether it be a retention election like we have in Iowa, or whether it is a more, whether it's a partisan election where there are candidates running against each other. You're actually asking the wrong person. I think you need to talk to the people who oppose the Utah ruling.
You are so right, and we're going to get to that. But just let me ask you one more question. I am curious, as you follow this issue as an attorney in private practice, right? How is same-sex marriage viewed now in Iowa? What are your impressions of how much has changed in 5 years?
Well, it has changed, and I'm not saying that just based solely on my impressions, but there has been polling done since 2010, and it shows that the citizens of Iowa now have a majority of support for same-sex marriage. And, in fact, the 2012 election included a retention election for one of the justices who participated in our 2009 decision, and he was retained.
Not very long. There's not so much time had passed.
No, but it does show that the public's view of same-sex marriage is changing, and I think it's significant that it changed in Iowa, where our citizens had several years of experience with it happening, and obviously it awakened some people and changed some people's minds.
Marsha Ternus is a former Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court, and she lost a retention election after ruling in favor of same-sex marriage in 2009. Brian Brown joins us now. He is Executive Director of the National Organization for Marriage, which works to prevent the legalization of same-sex marriage. Good to talk with you, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
So the National Organization for Marriage led a $1 million campaign in Iowa in 2009. Why did your organization pour so much money into those retention elections?
Well, it wasn't just the National Organization for Marriage. We were one of a number of groups that came together to help support it. And to say that it's outside money really doesn't do justice to the reality that we're a national group, just like the Human Rights Campaign on the other side, and have a lot of supporters within Iowa who said, what are we going to do next? And we were proud to help them and get the word out on what the justices had done. And ultimately, the money was just a way to get the message out. At the end of the day, part of a democracy is that the people get to make the decisions. And the people did make a right decision there. And they did vote to not retain the judges who, frankly, imposed their will on the voters of Iowa and came up with a wholly novel interpretation of the law, and we're seeing history repeat itself again. Look, someone's got to tell the truth here. You can use as many attempts to interpret due process and equal protection and have as long-winded an attempt to say that this applies here, but the emperor has no clothes. No judges until about 15 years ago would ever claim what this judge is claiming.
Let's follow through on the conversation about strategy. What strategy is your organization planning in response to this recent ruling in Utah?
Well, you know, as anyone who looks at the arguments over the U.S. Constitution at the Constitutional Convention can see, our founders did not envision that the judiciary would be the point at which law would be made. They thought that the judiciary would be the least threat to democracy. Unfortunately, that did not play out in this way. And so when we talk about judicial retention elections, in Iowa, this was a state judge. Here, this is a federal judge. The federal judge, there is no means by which you can have a vote and have the people have their say on this federal judge. The strategy, though, is clear. For all the talk about the sort of false polling that somehow the nation has turned a corner on this issue, we've done constant polling on this. And although there's been a slight drop-off, which I think should be expected given how many in the elite media and other places want to trumpet that this is inevitable, it's nowhere near a turning point. I think the strategy is now that in states where the people can vote and protect marriage from judges imposing their will, we will help to do that. But ultimately, we need to not allow the courts to trump the people. We can't allow the courts to be the branch that now is making up the law.
So what states are you focusing on? What states are you focusing on, and what strategy are you putting in on the ground, on the grassroots level?
Well, the strategy is we ultimately need a federal marriage amendment. And whether that comes through Congress, which obviously that will be a very difficult road, or whether it comes from state constitutional convention calls from the states, we support both methods. Look, 32 states still have marriage as the union of a man and a woman. Many of the states that are going to be affected if the 10th Circuit is to force gay marriage on the entirety of the 10th Circuit are very conservative states like Oklahoma, like Kansas, that understand that there's something profoundly wrong. So those state legislatures can push Congress to pass an amendment that once and for all says, okay, in this country, the court should not be forcing a redefinition of marriage. Marriage is something. It's unique and special. It's the union of one man and one woman. And that's what we're going to understand as a country. The next step in all of this is not simply same-sex marriage. We also have a case for polygamy moving up the courts. And given lower court rulings and given the logic of this ruling and what many of the guests have said, why not polygamy now? You know, if this is all about love and due process and the right to marry and that's what defines marriage, why not 3, 4, or 5 people? That is the next step, and it's already coming. It's already in lower courts.
Brian Brown is executive director of the National Organization for Marriage, which works to prevent the legalization of same-sex marriage. Reed Wilson is senior political policy blogger for The Washington Post. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, can you broaden the picture right now? Where do Republicans put gay marriage in their list of priorities right now?
Well, it's pretty low on the priority list. There is a measure moving through the Indiana state legislature right now that would put a same-sex marriage ban on this year's ballot. And even though the governor of Indiana, Mike Pence, is a pretty staunch conservative Republican, he has said it's not exactly at the top of his priority list. And most of the Republican state legislators, including the Speaker of the state house, have said that it is not one of their top priorities this year. They're likely to put the measure on the ballot anyway, but Republicans are increasingly disinterested in talking about same-sex marriage these days, largely because there are so many voters who have changed their mind on the issue, as Doug mentioned a few minutes ago. Polls across the spectrum show that voters, especially younger voters, are coming around and supporting same-sex marriage at a much higher rate than they have in previous years.
And to follow up on what Brian Brown was saying, how do the courts view gay marriage as compared with polygamy, which, as our guest was saying, these cases are also working their way through the courts? And I'm going to toss that to you, Doug Najame, also with us. He's an attorney and associate professor of law at UC Irvine.
Yeah, so the case that that Brian Brown was referring to is actually a case in Utah that doesn't challenge the legal recognition for polygamous marriages. Utah's law is actually unique. It's an anti-cohabitation law, so it prevents someone who's married from living with another individual in a cohabiting intimate relationship, sort of like an anti-adultery type law, but its aim is to prevent polygamous relationships regardless of legal recognition. And the plaintiffs in that case, who are actually the stars of a reality show about their relationship, were actually not seeking legal recognition of more than one marriage, but in fact simply lived together. And the district court judge in that case, didn't say anything about the legal recognition of polygamous relationships, but instead said that Utah's law that prevents people from living in unmarried relationships together was unconstitutional. And in fact, those types of anti-cohabitation statutes don't exist in most every other state and likely wouldn't withstand scrutiny at the U.S. Supreme Court.
Brian Brown, Executive Director of the National Organization for Marriage. I should give you a chance to respond to that. And that the case that Doug Najam is describing, it sounds like one specific case. And you can also weigh in on our other guest's point, Reed Wilson, that there's not a groundswell of support for polygamy.
Well, two things on that. The lead lawyer, Jonathan Turley, is well known in circles that support same-sex marriage. He himself is an advocate for same-sex marriage and has made no bones about the fact that his view is much broader, that once you accept the logic that any two people can marry, that marriage isn't based upon something unique and special about the sexes, and you accept the logic that somehow this is about people's wishes and desires and the subjective realm, that why not three, four, or five people? Why does the state have an interest in saying that three, four, or five people shouldn't be married and shouldn't have the same benefits if they want to make a commitment that goes to three, four, or five people? The logic becomes very hard to defend, and that's why there is a statement called Beyond Same-Sex Marriage, in which many legal scholars support giving legal benefits, rights, and the term marriage to polyamorous and polygamous relationships. This is not new. This is a statement that has been out for some time. Secondly, the notion that somehow public polling signifies some massive shift in same-sex marriage is just demonstrably false. There has been a shift, and it is true there's been a shift in younger voters, but the shift is not at a point now where even in this country, if you do a national poll, you won't see that a majority, a strong majority, still believes marriage is the union of a man and a woman. We did a poll 6 months ago. Our polling has been quite good, much better than any of the major news outlets. Our polling was exact when it came to North Carolina. There were actually polls put out by the Washington Post that said we might lose North Carolina. If you remember, North Carolina did pass a marriage amendment by 61%. And that was only a little over a year ago. So much can be made of the inevitability argument. What this is really about is trying to get as many same-sex marriages to occur in Utah as possible to make it much harder for the courts to roll this back. This judge knew what he was doing, and what he was doing was impose his will over the over two-thirds of the voters of Utah and strip them of their civil rights to have their votes respected and lifted up in law.
Brian Brown is Executive Director of the National Organization for Marriage. Reed Wilson is also with us. He's senior political policy blogger for the Washington Post. That's a mouthful, Reed. I'd like you to respond to Brian Brown's his assertion that public polling on support for gay marriage is, I think he said, demonstrably false.
He did. I'm struggling to understand where he comes up with that. I'm looking at the most recent Washington Post ABC News poll on this particular issue. A question is whether or not you support legalizing gay marriage. All respondents respond to 55% in favor, 40% against. Independent voters, 62% in favor, 35% against. Even Republicans, a third of Republicans said that they favor that. Anybody under the age of 39, more than 60% support legalizing gay marriage. So public opinion has shifted a lot over the last decade or so, and I think we've seen it shift even more dramatically in just the last few years, especially as so many of these states have come up with same-sex marriage laws. And by the way, let's be clear about this. It's not only through the courts that these legislatures have, that same-sex marriage has become legal. Some legislators have passed them. Back in 2012, four states, Washington, Minnesota, Maine, and Maryland, all voted in favor of gay marriage or against gay marriage bans. Back in 2004, the move to ban gay marriage was a political cudgel that Republicans used very effectively. Now it is we're to the point at which the next Democratic presidential nominee will almost certainly support same-sex marriage. There aren't many major Democratic elected officials who don't. So public opinion has certainly changed to the point at which even the elected officials who were frequently on the sort of on the back end of public opinion, who don't get there until their followers have led them, are now taking up the case.
Reed Wilson, senior political policy blogger for The Washington Post. Also, Doug Najam is with us, attorney and associate professor of law at UC Irvine. Doug, how do you respond to, again, Brian Brown's concern that the more gay couples who get married without a stay, it'll be harder to nullify these laws?
Yeah, I mean, the legal question itself won't change, and certainly we've seen, for instance, in California, when Mayor Newsom had ordered county clerks to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples, the California Supreme Court, which eventually struck down the state's marriage ban, said that those marriages were void. This is different because we have a federal district court opinion ruling the law unconstitutional, but I don't think as a legal matter it makes all that much difference. I think as a matter of public perception and mobilization of those supporting same-sex marriage, it makes a difference. The more same-sex married couples there are, the more likely people are to interact with married same-sex couples. People in Utah now will be having neighbors who are married to same-sex couples, and that does, we see, change people's perceptions of the issue. And knowing people who are gay or lesbian and seeing same-sex couples has an impact on how people perceive this issue, regardless of the legal merits.
Reed Wilson, senior political policy blogger for The Washington Post. Can you explain to us how the public and what the polls tell us about how the public views abortion and how it views gay marriage and whether they're in the same camp?
Well, I don't think they are. Opinion on abortion specifically has been remarkably static over the last several decades. I mean, this is a debate that has been playing out since Roe v. Wade was decided, and something that you know, Democrats and Republicans both talk to their bases about, the you know, independent voters. Let's put it this way: there are very few people who are undecided about abortion. Everybody's either very much in favor of it or very much against it. There's not a lot of middle ground. On the other hand, there are quite a large number of people who have been swayed, were clearly undecided about same-sex marriage, or at least their opinions were malleable. As Doug brings up, I mean, one of the big benefits to same-sex marriage over the last couple of years, one of the reasons for its growing acceptance is because we've seen a lot more you know, gay characters on sitcoms, and we've seen the sort of gay marriage has happened and the world hasn't ended, and so this is that sort of leads some people to think, well, hey, you know, why not to come off the fence, if you will. You know, I mentioned the Washington Post poll that showed 55% supporting, 40% against. That still means 15% of Americans haven't made up their mind on this issue. I guarantee you there are not 15% of Americans who have not made up their mind on abortion. They're either for it or against it.
Reed Wilson, senior political policy blogger for The Washington Post. Doug Najem, attorney and associate professor of law at UC Irvine, concerning this this concern that judicial activism is at work on the same-sex marriage issue, do you think that will come up should the Supreme Court finally come down on the constitutionality of gay marriage?
I mean, what's happening is the courts are responding to all of the other changes that we see. And so this isn't an instance in which the courts are far out ahead of what's happening on the ground. As Reed mentioned, legislatures have been passing marriage laws. Voters supported same-sex marriage in a sweep in November 2012. And so what the courts are actually doing now is very much in line with what elected officials and the public has been doing over the past couple years. And I don't think, when you talk about the comparisons to abortion, that a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately finding same-sex marriage bans unconstitutional would yield the type of counter-mobilization that we've seen in the wake of decisions like Roe versus Wade. I think it's clear where we're heading on this issue, and the court in many ways would be pushing the country along in that direction, and I don't think we'd see much intense mobilization to try to roll that back.
Doug Najem, attorney and a professor of law at UC Irvine. Also with us today, Reed Wilson, senior political policy blogger for The Washington Post, and Brian Brown, executive director of the National Organization for Marriage. Also, Brooke Adams joined us, social justice reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, and earlier, Marcia Ternus, former chief justice of the Iowa Supreme Court. Thanks to all of you. In a moment, the world's top five grossing movies of 2013 were all franchises. And plenty more are on the way. Will we ever get enough of these stories, or have we already? That's today's Talking Point after the break. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
We're back with our talking point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren, only on To The Point. Iron Man 3, Despicable Me 2, Fast and Furious 6. The most successful hits of 2013 were all franchises, whether they had a number after their title or not. Why does Hollywood keep returning to the same stories, and will it ever end? Kim Masters is editor-at-large for The Hollywood Reporter and the host of The Business here on KCRW in Santa Monica, and it's a pleasure to talk with you, Kim.
I'm happy to be here.
So the multi-million dollar question, why so many franchises and sequels?
Well, it's a very cluttered marketplace. People have lots and lots of entertainment options. And when something is recognizable, then people have a sense of what it is. And you're not necessarily trying this very daunting challenge of selling them on something brand new that they've never heard of. They kind of know what Iron Man is. They know what Monsters, Inc. was. You know, they know what Fast and Furious is. There have been six of them. So those are the films that are easier to sell. And with the cost of marketing these days and the amount of clutter out there, that counts.
So are franchises consistently popular around the world? Is that the part of the economic picture here? Or do some countries opt out? And I'm just hoping you'll say the French are too sophisticated.
Well, the bottom line is the great majority of revenue from films comes from overseas markets. And in a lot of those overseas markets, and we'll leave France out of the equation, these franchises are, they're what they call pre-sold. So people go in and they tend to return. And things that you might think, why did they bother here? You know, something like a G.I. Joe, or even a Star Trek was disappointing here domestically. There's still, and Star Trek is a bad example, so scratch that one, but there are still plenty of examples of movies that do okay here and great overseas. Sometimes you're just astonished to see the number that comes in from overseas on a movie that didn't do that well here.
And Hollywood has particular eyes for China, correct? That's what's driving
China,
this in large part?
Well, to some degree. I mean, right now, China actually gives less of the revenue from a movie to the studios than other foreign markets do. But the potential is so vast, and the screens in China are just growing at such an aggressive rate. It will be the top movie market in the world within a very short time, within a very few years now. And so Hollywood is knocking its head very hard against that, I hate to say, great wall to try and get into that market. And they have to some degree. They've had a considerable amount of success. At the same time, the Chinese are to some degree fending Hollywood off. They want to protect their homegrown product.
And can you give us a rundown of just what the cost is of marketing films and how this figures in?
Well, if you're looking, it depends on, you know, the movie, but if you're, it can easily add $50 million, $100 million, $150 million to the cost of marketing a film. I mean, if you're looking at a big franchise movie, you're looking at the higher end of that spectrum. And so, of course, you know, the when you look at a gross for a movie, you know, you can say, you can look at a movie, there are several examples of this, you know, that happened this year. A movie like World War Z, you know, that is a movie where they're going to do a sequel. It was a very troubled production. It was extraordinarily expensive to make and market, and the gross looks huge. It looks like, you know, a $500 million plus gross, but by the time you factor in the fact that the studio only keeps, let's call it, roughly half of that money, and the fact of the cost of marketing, which is going to be in excess of $100 million for that movie, you are barely walking away with a win. You know, you're just getting a thin margin of victory on a very expensive and time-sucking piece of business.
Well, I'm afraid to ask this then, but will this ever end?
I don't know.
You know, are there any lessons to be learned from Gravity? I'm really tipping my aesthetic hand here, but or the smaller indie films like Enough Said with James Gandolfini or The Way, Way Back. Any lessons for Hollywood there?
Well, Gravity is a different kettle of fish. I mean, that was a very bold gamble for Warner Brothers. It paid off very, very handsomely. And, you know, that is the kind of thing that studios dream about. But we've seen studios try to launch even semi original films like The Lone Ranger, and they got killed. Disney's going to lose close to $200 million on that film. Having said all of that, these smaller films, you know, they'll play in that space for a limited amount of money, looking for partners to help pay for them, but this is not what they're really about. They will continue with these franchises, and they're going to try and play it as safe as they can for the foreseeable future.
So just in the last minute, what should we expect in 2014? Besides more of the same.
Yeah, you will see more of the same, and then you'll see some films that break out. I mean, you know, that die is already cast. Those films are being finished now. Those films are long since greenlit. The films we're talking now about, what are the ideas that they will have for 2016, 17, 18 maybe, or beyond. These things take 18 months to pull together. And I think the studios are going to be very wary of trying to launch original ideas as they have been. And I think they'll make fewer films because the risks are so staggering.
And just very briefly, January usually is dumping ground. Any high points?
I think the high point is will be when you catch up on all the Oscar films. We have a particularly good year for Oscar films. You know, usually I have a hard time thinking of even four that are worth being nominating. And this year I can easily come up with a list of 10 or more that wouldn't be embarrassing. So catch up on those.
Great. Kim Masters is editor-at-large for The Hollywood Reporter and the host of The Business here on KCRW in Santa Monica. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.